I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about metabolism and weight control. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Dr. Reza Yavari is here. He is an endocrinologist. He trained at Yale, and he has spent so many years studying weight loss research on behalf of his patients who need to shed some pounds. Some have diabetes or pre-diabetes. Some are obese, and this is why Reza knows so much about this, and we love to have him on the show on a regular basis to talk about all these things. Well, first thing I want to talk about is I want to talk about Jacques Pepin, who is our dear friend and is in great shape, as it turns out. We're grateful for that. Can you give me a report?
Sure. First, thank you again for having me. It's always a pleasure. So Jacques had a mild stroke last week, and he's fully recovered. He's 100%. I've seen him both at the hospital and at his house with his family, and you could never tell. And I think it's appropriate to bring it up because he would want his fans to know that he is fine and he's going to resume his schedule. And I'm sure you will see him as before in the media as often as he would like to.
Yeah, good. So, well, that's good because I have many, many things I plan to eat with him and Gloria. So I'm glad to hear that his appetite is not in any way affected. And he also, there are now two dogs.
That's
which
right.
Which is very exciting.
Gaston and Paco.
I was going to say, this Paco has competition now. But good to have twins in the house. Okay, so off and running we go. I want to ask you about when people are on various kinds of diets, everybody is always searching for the thing that will work for this particular person. So you're on a diet. Is there a standard about when diets kick in for most people? You know, you begin, and how long does it take for things to show up on your body in some way, whether it's loss of pounds on the scale, or clothing fitting differently?
Well, this is a really good and somewhat tough question to answer because everybody's different. As a rule, when men and women want to lose weight and they follow a diet, the weight loss often correlates well with their caloric deficit. In other words, how many calories they burn versus how many calories they consume. Well, women in general, because they have less muscle, they burn less calories. So if they go on a diet, then let's say their husband is on, they may not lose any weight because they less so few calories compared to their husband. So as a rule, we want a 1,000-calorie deficit a day, which translates for most people to 2 pounds a week. Now, if you're a big, strong man with lots of muscle, and if you ate, let's say, 1,200, 1,400 calories a day, you would lose more than that, maybe 3 or 4 pounds a week. But there are a lot of variables here. One of them, for example, has to
do... Well, that's not a good idea for women, is it, Reza? Excuse me for interrupting.
No problem.
Is that right?
Well, in my experience, most women don't lose weight if they eat more than 1,400 calories of food. Of course, if they exercise a lot, if they're very young, they may still lose weight. But in my experience, most women burn somewhere between 1,600 and 2,000 calories a day at rest. So to have a significant weight loss, you have to have a caloric deficit of 1,000 calories, which makes it difficult and perhaps even unhealthy and unrealistic for women to just lose weight with caloric restriction. They also have to exercise. And of course, we have previously talked about there are other ways to raise your metabolism with the frequency of food intake, the type of food you eat, that getting good night's sleep, exercising the appropriate way, maybe putting on some muscle to lose fat. These are all ways that people who burn less calories can still lose weight.
Yeah, there's a study that comes out every 2 minutes, and one is counteracting another one. So, you know, they will tell us that the body gets used to the level of exercise you're doing, so you either have to up the exercise, the amount of time, the weights you're using, do something more strenuous. That makes it sound like it's a losing battle. What if you're someone who, CDC, is it CDC that says 30 minutes a day of exercise is ideally what every person should do? Well, then what about this idea that the body gets used to exercise? It makes you feel like that is a losing battle.
Well, there are other benefits to exercise than weight loss. 30 minutes a day of gentle exercise is good for many different things. It may not yield a lot of weight loss, but it's good for the heart. It's good for the mind. It's good for general fitness. It's good for diabetes, which we're going to talk about later. But in general, our bodies do tend to get used to what we do, exercise, food, and so on. And we do have to change things around every few weeks, every few months. And also, again, everybody is different. Some people max out on their muscle, and the exercise that they would do for building muscle is no longer working for them, and they're just going to get injured. Some people have a lot of muscle, and all they have to do is move around, and they burn fat. So everybody's a little different.
And some people come into the world with a metabolism that seems to be set on high. I can't tell you the numbers of times I have seen people who seem to consume enormous amounts of food and alcohol. And I say to them, these are beanpole people. And I say to them, how in the world do you do that? And they say, I don't even try. I don't do anything to counteract this. My metabolism is just set on high. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. And those are the people that nobody really likes, because they can do whatever they want and they stay lean and slim. Some of it is genetically wired. Some of it has to do with epigenetics. In other words, what happens to our genes when we are in our fetal stages and early childhood stages. And then some of it has to do with lifestyle. So, our genes determine a lot of what we do, but some of them can be modified.
Do you mean that early in life, there's something that
there's some data that in utero, when you are still a fetus, if your mother eats a certain type of foods, let's say high carb, you can modify your genes through a process called imprinting or methylation, which affects your metabolism later in life. There's also evidence.
In which direction?
Well, you could gain weight. You could become obese from it or overweight. There's also some evidence that if you're born premature or with a very small weight, it could affect your risk of diabetes and your metabolism later in life. So we don't quite understand it all, but it is clearly a spectrum from genetics all the way to lifestyle as adults.
Oh, boy, that's interesting. Okay, so let's talk about something that this pre-diabetes that we hear that phrase tossed around a lot. People will say he's at risk for pre-diabetes. We don't want him to get the official diagnosis of pre-diabetes. What is it?
Well, pre-diabetes is, for most people, refers to a range in the fasting blood sugar. If the fasting blood sugar is less than 100 milligrams per deciliter, you're normal. If it's between 100 and 110, you're pre-diabetic, and so on. But beyond just the glycemic, the blood sugar values, which also vary from person to person, from night to night, there's a lot of other matters that are happening in your body when you're pre-diabetic. So, for example, when you're pre-diabetic, you don't respond to food the same way as someone who's normal. A couple of years ago, I put a sensor on my body that would measure my blood sugars 24/7. And I said, oh, I'm going to challenge myself with Chardonnay versus Pinot Noir, Chinese food versus pizza, to see which one raises my blood sugar. And guess what? That experiment failed miserably because I could not raise my blood sugar above 140 no matter what I did and what I ate. So it just shows you I wasn't pre-diabetic and I'm not pre-diabetic. But if someone is pre-diabetic and they do an experiment like that, they will see that their blood sugars can go sky high with certain meals, and especially with high-carb meals.
And pre-diabetic means at risk for full type 2 diabetes, correct?
Later on, yes. The conversion is about 10 years' time. In other words, if you're pre-diabetic today and you don't do something about it, in 10 years, roughly, you will have diabetes.
So you can... Is there? Can you do something to keep yourself from... Is everyone at risk for being pre-diabetic?
Yeah, the whole world is. We have about 500 million diabetics in the world now, and estimate is in about 10 years we'll have 1 billion diabetics in the world. So those 500 million people who are pre-diabetic could still do something about it.
So is this caused by lifestyle, food intake, or genetics?
Well, again, it's a mixed bag, but the biggest argument about it not being genetic, at least not fully genetic, is that we haven't changed our genes in the last 50 years. I mean, human beings have been evolving in the last 2 million years, and in 50 years, we're increasing the risk of diabetes by 100% every 10 years. So it is some degree genetic because different people respond differently to the challenges we face today. But overall, as a super epidemic, it is probably both lifestyle and environmental.
So if you are someone who is, some people have a vulnerability to kidney issues, to heart issues, to lung problems. If you're someone who has a genetic vulnerability to diabetes, how do you know that? What is, with the heart, you can check that. What can you do to... Does it have to do with which relatives have had it before you or all these other things that we were talking about? How can you know if that's one of your serious vulnerabilities, aside from the fact that we all are vulnerable to it?
Right. So family history of type 2 diabetes, adult onset diabetes, increases the risk of the person we're talking about. Gestational diabetes, diabetes during pregnancy, increases the risk of diabetes later in life for that given person. That given woman. And in addition to that, sedentary lifestyle, weight gain, perhaps some medications, all increase risk of type 2 diabetes.
What medications?
Well, there are certain medications, we mentioned them last time, that raise blood sugar and can cause diabetes. And some of those are the mood regulators that psychiatrists prescribe. Some of them could be simply prednisone, which we use often for inflammatory conditions. That raises blood sugar. And there are many others.
Obviously, for many people, treating that depression is as important as the issue of diabetes, correct?
That's correct. And depression is... if it's not treated, could lead to diabetes in other ways. For example, overeating, emotional eating, stress, sedentary lifestyle. So it is important to treat the depression, but it's also important to advise the patient that this medication could cause high blood sugars and eventually diabetes.
If everybody is at risk for pre-diabetes, other than in a genetic way, I'd love to know on the other side of this quick break, Dr. Reza Yavari, who's a metabolic specialist at Yale and in Madison, Connecticut. I'd love to know what you can do to stay away from prediabetes. And we'll be right back. I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you so much for listening. I am with Dr. Reza Yavari, who is an endocrinologist and runs Beyond Care in Madison, Connecticut, and is also on the staff of the New England Medical Group of Yale University in Trumbull, Connecticut. And we are talking now about prediabetes. So if we're all vulnerable to that, what can we do to lower that vulnerability, to not become pre-diabetic?
Well, essentially, you would have to live a healthy lifestyle, get very lean, make sure you don't have excess belly fat, eat healthy, fresh foods, low carb, low fat, and make sure you get good sleep. Sleep hygiene is very important. And exercise on a regular basis to keep the muscles hungry for sugar. So it's basically what we call a therapeutic lifestyle change, which would result in fat loss. That's our goal. The leaner a person is and the more muscular they are, the least likely the chance of diabetes in the long term.
And in terms of environmental, we see diabetes going up in inner cities. What do you think that's about?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the choice of foods, access to good foods, access to fitness facilities. But there are also many chemicals and products in our foods, and whether it's fast food, whether it's food we buy in the supermarket, that can cause prediabetes and maybe diabetes in the long term. One of them is thought to be BPA, bisphenol A, which is coming from plastics into our foods, that acts like a what we call an endocrine disruptor, acts like a hormone in the body and can result in a number of problems, including obesity and diabetes.
So are you saying, or is there a chance, I know this is not your field necessarily, that all those people who are drinking even diet soda out of plastic bottles, spent years doing that, might in fact be affected by the plastic itself more than the contents of those bottles?
Well, the research is ongoing, but there is evidence both in animal studies and epidemiological studies that some chemicals that we find in our food, which we also refer to as obesogens, can cause diabetes and obesity. But there are obviously other factors involved. It's always a very complex picture. But let me ask you this question. If you have a 15, 16-year-old pediatric patient who weighs 200, 250 pounds in your office, what would you think? That person, that child, has not been on this planet long enough to overeat to obesity. So obviously there's something that's causing that child to become obese in addition to food intake, in addition to perhaps too much of video game playing. And I truly believe there are environmental factors that are behind a lot of the pediatric obesity that we can otherwise not explain. The math just doesn't work out for a child to be 100 pounds overweight.
That's so interesting. I really have never heard anybody say it quite like that before. That's really interesting. Rezi Avari. What about emotional eating? What is the way around that?
Well, first, what is emotional eating?
Yeah, I was going to say, here you're someone who does this for a living. You help people. You're such a good coach about this kind of thing. Do you ever face that yourself? Emotional eating.
Personally?
Yes.
Thank God, no. Emotional drinking, I can be aware of, but not emotional eating. I'm not the kind of person who has an emotional and perhaps unhealthy relationship with food that people have. So what is emotional eating? And this is important for practitioners to know, to be able to identify the tendencies that their patients have that could lead to obesity and diabetes. One is one type of emotional eating is eating out of sadness or setbacks, and we resort to binge eating, usually comfort foods, ice cream, foods that have to do with our childhood, food that make us feel warm and cozy, food that make us forget things, perhaps of too much sugar in it. And we just get numb. So there's that aspect of emotional eating, which often results in binging. Then there's emotional eating out of cravings. In other words, it's not necessarily the quantity of the food, but it's more like the cravings of certain type, usually sweets or salty things, that drives us crazy. That's almost like an addiction. And in fact, that kind of eating responds to medications that are usually used for addiction. Then there's, of course, stress eating, which is a form of emotional eating where when you just are really stressed out and tired and exhausted, the only way you can settle down is by resorting to snacks. Again, sugars, candies in the office, at home. And a lot of times what men do, this is just an observation, is we get home and we eat bigger portions, second servings. We go make another peanut butter sandwich late at night, a cheese sandwich, and so on. And all of this has to do with emotional eating, meaning that we are responding with food to an emotion. And it's important for, again, people, us, to know what we are at risk of, what we tend to do, but also to communicate that with our practitioners because they can help us.
How can you, in a way, be mindful? Because the very thing you need to not do that is the thing that's being affected, your brain.
Well, you need a coach, or you can be your own coach by writing down what you eat and be honest with yourself. Even if you know you binged, if you tend to be honest about it, you can find solutions, you can find alternatives, you can be proactive and avoid those responses. There are many ways that you can use, for example, affirmations. You can do exercise to replace overeating. There are many solutions, but first you have to be honest and mindful, and then you have to be accountable. You can't cheat.
So let's come back to muscle mass in people. We're still on this pre-diabetes or full-blown type 2 diabetes. I don't mean the childhood adult onset diabetes, which is very, very serious and happens most often in childhood, but type 2 diabetes, which is serious in itself. So you've been telling me that healthy muscle mass is very important for people with diabetes.
Yes, and in fact, a lot of times when I give lectures, I ask the audience, what is the organ in the body that uses the most amount of sugar? And most people raise their hands and say brain. No, the brain doesn't use the most amount of sugar. Sugar is used primarily in muscles. We call that glucose uptake. And if you do not have enough muscles, or if your muscles are lazy and kind of like marbled with fat, like the kind of fatty steaks that we buy, they're not going to use the glucose in the body, and it just goes around and around and doesn't get absorbed. So people with poor musculature or bad quality muscles, if they exercised and build muscle, they would see a big difference in their blood sugars within a week.
How many people did you tell me have diabetes right now? Did you say?
In the world, about 500 million people estimated.
So I'm writing it down, 500 million. And you said, at what point is it going to be a billion?
In 10 years.
So in 10 years, a billion. Around the world?
Yes, okay. Around the world.
Okay, so with a health problem like that, why isn't it like any other disease that is scheduled to strike that many people? Why wouldn't there be a public health intervention? Why wouldn't everybody be put on a tiny dose of some kind of diabetes medication?
Well, that is a good question. First of all, for the longest time, obesity and excess weight were considered a lifestyle choice. We now know that officially, as of 2 years ago, the Institute of Medicine and Medicare considers obesity a medical condition. So more serious actions are being taken by policymakers and medical schools and research centers to address this. We also know that, unfortunately, diabetes is called the silent killer because you can be unaware that you have diabetes for years and years because it doesn't bother you necessarily. It's causing damage in the body, but it certainly doesn't cause pain or other limitations that would make you run to the doctor. So it's a silent condition that comes on slowly over time, and therefore by the time we are aware of it, it is a lot of times a little too late to reverse it at least. So in terms of population-based approaches to diabetes, in the last 10 years, we've made a lot of progress, at least in the U.S. We now have many, many studies that show diabetes can be prevented with lifestyle change. Many, many studies have analyzed how that information can be translated on a larger scale to reach out to various populations, clinics, hospitals, churches, employee fitness centers, and so on. And we are going to win this battle, just like we won the battle with seatbelts and hopefully soon with smoking. We are going to win the battle against diabetes due to lifestyle and obesity. It's just not very cost-effective to use medications alone.
But the cost of diabetes, striking a billion people as it's projected, how much drama is in that figure, do you think? Do you think it's accurate?
I think it's accurate, and I think the cost of diabetes may very well exceed the whole healthcare expenditure if nothing is done.
Well, then how can they say it's not cost-effective to give everybody a little diabetes medicine? I mean, I so hear you. You're saying there's no need to go straight to medicine. There are other interventions that appear to be doing the trick. But
well,
I don't know.
A good example would be the use of cholesterol-lowering agents and reduction of death from cardiovascular disease.
Yes, that's
many of us are taking statins because the risk reduction benefits versus risks are much in favor of taking statins if you're at high risk than not. But nonetheless, it is very difficult at the societal level to promote any kind of medication on the large scale. I think we will get there if we don't win the battle with therapeutic lifestyle change.
And have we ever convinced this many people that we're talking about here, a billion people, to engage in an activity or stop engaging in an activity and as a public health model that would affect this size population? I mean, have we ever done this before?
Well, there have been now half a dozen large-scale studies in the U.S. that have been very well designed and followed for years. Diabetes Prevention Program, DPP, mm-hmm. was the first one. It's now in its year, I believe, 12 or so, and it showed clearly, and it was the first large-scale study that showed diabetes can be prevented with lifestyle change. Mm-hmm. In that study, an arm of it had metformin, a medication, also which showed it can be effective. And diabetes prevention ended up being cost-effective 10 years out, even if people had gained most of the weight back. So even if people gained the weight back, those years that were healthy is like money in the bank. They are better off now than if they never lost the weight and never engaged in lifestyle change. So there have been other studies since then, and many more studies are in the works. We know that diabetes at the early stages of type 2 can definitely be prevented or reversed. And we know diabetes can be better managed, avoiding complications, even at later stages with healthy eating, exercise, and behavior modification.
I think I'm really trying to get at, I'm pressing you because I'm trying to get at whether it's realistic to think that without the kind of intervention I'm talking about, a medicine, is it realistic to think that we could get a billion people to do what health professionals are hoping for?
It is realistic because we don't ask a lot. All we ask is 30 minutes of exercise a day, a weight loss of 5 to 7, hopefully 7 to 10%, eating healthy food, including a low-carb diet, and basically general hygiene with sleep and lifestyle. I know it. You're saying that.
I'm trying not to laugh because I'm thinking, you know, that healthy people and people, not under stress have trouble with that list of things. You know, keeping that in balance, being a balanced person in the world is pretty tough.
Well, there are also incentives put in place by employers and insurance companies and so on to help people stay motivated for various different compensations, monetary and otherwise. Education is important. Yes, I agree with you. It's not. It sounds easy. I know for a fact I'm in the trenches. I know it is hard to do it. It's even harder to maintain that. It's even harder to relapse the weight gain later. But we may not have a choice. We're all in it together, and we have to do the best we can.
Dr. Ray Zayavari, thanks for sticking with me on that. We are going to keep going and find out how stress is raising blood sugar and what stressors diabetes itself causes in people. It doesn't always start with us, but the illness itself causes stress reaction within the body. And Dr. Zayavari is going to talk about that with us and more things about weight control. Call us, 203-776-WNPR, if you'd like to join the conversation with a question. 203-776-WNPR. Metabolic specialist Dr. Zayavari joins me again right after this break. Stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you so much for listening. And thanks also to our producers, Lori Mack and Jonathan McNichol. My guest is Dr. Ray Zayavari. He's a metabolic specialist and endocrinologist and operates a practice called Beyond Care in Madison, Connecticut, and also is part of the New England Medical Group of Yale in Trumbull, Connecticut. And here back with us again, he's a frequent guest on the show to talk about this time, pre-diabetes, which we are all in danger of developing because of the way all of our lives go, and then full-blown diabetes. And so we're talking about that. Dr. Zayavari says that within the profession, it is estimated that within the next 10 years, 1 billion people around the world will have diabetes. And that is an astonishing thing. We were talking, I was trying to press you, as you heard, about whether it would be possible to give people some kind of supplement to prevent this. You said during the break that in England there is talk about giving a supplement of to mimic statins. Because heart disease is so prevalent. That's the kind of thing that I'm talking about. Are there supplements that affect, that we can buy now generally, if the actual ingredients are in them, that would affect blood sugar insulin resistance and affect our blood sugar to the extent to be helpful in preventing prediabetes or diabetes?
There are some supplements that are known to lower blood sugar if they are able to prevent diabetes or reverse insulin resistance. I frankly don't know. But chromium picolinate, cinnamon, and an herb which we use in cooking called fenugreek, which is an Indian herb, lower blood sugars, and people can take them safely. It may not reverse diabetes by any means, but if they have slightly elevated blood sugars, it can certainly help.
And we know that for a fact?
Yes.
And so, in other words, studies show this to be true. I guess the thing, the world we live in right now, is you want to know whether these substances have any actual ingredient in them.
Well, again, nothing beats food. If it's in the food, like cinnamon, and you feel good after you add cinnamon to your diet, and you know that there's a chance it may help lower blood sugar, it's perfectly safe.
So fenugreek.
Fenugreek is an herb that is a little pungent, so people take it as a capsule dried up, but I actually cook with it. I love it.
And chromium picolinate.
Yes, that's a mineral that made a lot of noise a few years ago. Mm-hmm. It ended up not being the cure-all, but it does lower blood sugars.
If you are someone and you have members of your family making you higher risk for prediabetes or diabetes, is it a good idea to look at these three things in combination?
I don't think it hurts, but I don't think the studies are there to support these particular supplements having a diabetes prevention or risk reduction benefit.
So should I not be talking about them at all then?
Well, they can lower blood sugar for somebody who, let's say, has slightly elevated blood sugars because of lifestyle, poor sleep, maybe a little bit of excess belly fat, or maybe they have a sweet tooth. It certainly helps. It doesn't hurt to use them.
Janine, thanks for calling 203-776-WNPR. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
As an alternative to the supplement idea, what about if we were trying to correct the food sources, such as antibiotics in the meats, flavor additives in fast foods, having fruit and vegetables more available to people who live in the city, things of this nature? I mean, that could also help affect a billion people instead of medications.
Well, Janine, what about what Dr. Vari, Janine's talking about, this idea?
Well,
of-
I agree. I mean, I certainly the first target should be healthy eating aimed at diabetes reversal or prevention. I can tell you from personal experience, when I put my patients who are either borderline diabetic or even on insulin on my meal plans, within 3 days, they either drop their blood sugars to normal levels or have to reduce their insulin intake, depending on what stage of diabetes they're in. But definitely food intake, the choice of foods, the composition of the food in terms of carbs, fat, and protein makes a huge difference. And of course, food additives, food chemicals, coloring, and so on. We don't know much about them causing diabetes, but it makes sense to eat as healthy, organic, chemical-free as possible. I don't think anybody would argue with that.
Janine,
yeah, and I think globally, you know, we could approach this by going somewhat after the food industry to help all of us, because a lot of the things that they're adding supposedly are unfortunately affecting all of us to gain weight and have trouble losing it.
Thank you, Janine, so much for your comment.
Okay,
really appreciate it. You said that on the eating plan that you construct for people, insulin levels change dramatically within 3 days, 72 hours. So what's the structure of what you're telling them?
Well, our meal plans are very simple. I mean, they're low in carbs, low in animal fat. We don't cut back on protein, and the total amount is tailored to the patient's body composition, age, activity, and so on. But if they have diabetes, and that's the topic today, the fact that they're eating low amounts of healthy carbs, meaning very little fast-absorbing sugars, no candy, no sweets, the carbs are primarily coming from vegetables, and we keep them about 100 grams a day or less. On that kind of a regimen, my experience for the last 20 years has been that within 3-4 days, honestly, I have to cut the insulin dose by 50%.
Wow. So on the higher protein, correct?
Well, we don't cut back on the protein. We cut back on the fat and the carbs. So relatively speaking, it becomes a high protein, but it's not excessive or additional amount of protein that they would normally eat.
And the protein, do you care if it's red meat versus?
We know we care that it's low fat.
Okay.
So it's lean choices, because fat can actually cause insulin resistance by itself.
Huh. So in terms of what the old Atkins diet used to do, where the amount of fat that you had in the early days of that diet, that was the wrong way to go?
No, it's a very, extreme way to go. We don't need to eat a lot of fat to reverse the process of insulin sensitivity and diabetes reversal. What we need to do is provide the body with enough protein and carbs and lean choices of meats so that metabolism keeps revving up without adding factors that increase insulin resistance. And we know that dietary fat increases insulin resistance, in particular in conjunction with excess carb intake. So a lean diet, small, frequent meals every 3 hours is the way to go.
A lean diet of small, lean meals every 3 hours is the way to go.
Right, right. We want about 4 to 6 ounces of protein-rich food for meals and about 2 ounces for snacks.
Ellen Faith Middleton with Dr. Ray Ziavari. Go ahead.
Hi, Faith.
Hi.
First of all, I love your shows.
Thank you.
I am a type 2 diabetic, and I'm 67. When I was 65 and went on Medicare, my supplement to the Medicare was AARP. And they offer something called the Silver Sneaker Program to people over 65 through the ARP insurance. And I'm exercising for free at Health Tracks 3 days a week, an hour each day.
Do you mean that they said we'll pay for that?
Yes, they pay for that, and it's, I guess, not just AARP, but there's other health insurance supplements to Medicare that offer the program. Mm. It's nationwide, and I'll tell you, I was not much of a mover or a groover most of my life, so this has really helped in terms of my health. I feel better. I have more energy. My sugars are lower than they were. I still don't eat exactly right, but it's better.
Hmm. And did it make a difference to you that it's free?
Well, in my case, it sure helps because I could not afford to join a gym otherwise.
Yeah, I think I'm trying to get at what piece of this really worked for you. So you tried it because it's free, but then sustaining it is another issue. What made you keep going?
Oh, well, I'll tell you what. I have just learned to love this program, the camaraderie with the people in there. It's an enormous class. Our instructors are terrific, and it's geared to people 65 and older. We have people in our class in their 90s, and it's a fantastic workout. And so I'm feeling good about myself, and the fact that it's free was just a no-brainer.
A bonus, so. Yeah. Well, that's great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your call.
Thank you.
Interesting, Reza.
Yeah, there are other organizations that participate in that, including YMCA and some of the community centers. This is an offshoot of the diabetes prevention program results that we talked about earlier. So very good.
Don Faith Middleton with Dr. Ray Ziavari. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you doing, Faith?
Thank you so much. Thank you.
I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
One of your previous callers did make the point I was going to go to is just how difficult it is to really, have a quality diet. And when you go to the store, you can walk down whole aisles of food where they're just all poor choices. And so to try to really, come out of there with, the kind of food that you're really supposed to eat, it's sort of a daunting challenge in a lot of ways.
What do they say? Stay away from, what's the guide to stay away from the center aisles?
Right.
Just do the perimeter of the supermarket, I think, is the way to end up with healthy things in your cart.
I've been diabetic for a while, and I've managed it, and it's actually better now than it's ever been. But it sure took a long time, and it sure took some of the choices that the doctor's talking about, where you just need to just apply it, and if you do, the results do work. I mean, I'm pleased with how I'm managing, but I can just see it's the food industry is just fraught with they just sort of push it on you, and even if you're not diabetic. The stuff that you're putting in your body today, it leads you down that path.
It does. I think, Don, you're talking about how it's this food is engineered now to appeal to us. We're now genetically modifying things to bring out the sugars in them, and so you crave that more.
Right.
I'm talking about foods that we would consider quote unquote natural, and then there are all the other foods that we quickly label junk food that's engineered to just be fabulous. I mean, they're geniuses at it.
Well, it's great food. It's wonderful to eat, but it doesn't do you much good.
I get your point. I'm just saying what a battle this is to stay away from this stuff. Thank you so much for your call. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Dr. Rezivari.
I was just going to ask the caller, but that's okay. No problem. One of the things that we need to also remind people is that our understanding of diabetes evolves, and when I was in training years ago, we weren't even sure if managing hemoglobin A1C, which is the average blood sugar surrogate, if lowering it below 8 would have any benefits. Now we know it does. We didn't know whether weight loss would have any benefits. We know it does. And now we're also developing a lot of very new medications that are very effective. They often help people with diabetes lose weight. They preserve the pancreatic insulin production longer. So we are making progress in the therapeutic arm of things too. And of course, the food industry needs to listen better to the demographic change. The politicians need to pay more attention to obesity and diabetes. It is not a soundbite. It requires discussion. And a lot of times the media is not interested in engaging in it. But on the other hand, scientists and doctors are making progress too. Mm-hmm. So overall, the picture in the future is brighter than it was 20 years ago.
And there's individual responsibility. I think that's what Don mm-hmm. was talking about too, where these are choices that each of us get to make. Rich, welcome to the show. As quickly as you can, Rich.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a physician. I just wanted to add very quickly. I'm hopeful to hear this topic of this show, although I'm a little disappointed at the subdued nature. This is a cure, what this gentleman's discussing with you. It is a cure. Of all the things in medicine that we manage as a chronic disease, this is a cure. But if you take tobacco as the example, we don't look for a pill to mitigate the complications of tobacco use, cancer or vascular complications. But yet, we want a pill to mitigate the effects of our lifestyle, which are directly related to how we live and what we put in our mouth. So I just wanted to add that there's no supplements. The only hope and only cure is a plant-based diet. Get rid of processed foods in our diet, which is a difficult task because it is labor-intensive to live this kind of a lifestyle. But it is the only answer, and it is the cure.
Thank you, Rich.
That's all I had to say.
Okay. Thanks so much for your comments. So next time, no, Reza, do you want to?
Oh, just real quickly, I agree with the doctor, but there is a time where we have to intervene medically mm-hmm. to help management of diabetes and even perhaps early stage reversal of it. That lifestyle change is then only complementary. That there is a place for medical intervention. The earlier, the better.
All right. Thank you so much for coming back on the show. As always, Dr. Reza Yavari is in Madison, Connecticut at Beyond Care, and he is also part of the Northeast Medical Group at Yale, which is based in Trumbull, Connecticut. Thanks again, Reza. As always, this show is about the richness of life, and you can find the books, people, recipes, information about Dr. Yavari, and our information on diabetes and prediabetes control at WNPR.org, the Faith Middleton Show. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.